To the book of Ruth this morning. The book of Ruth. It's a small book tucked in between the books of Judges and 1 Samuel. And if you're using one of our pew Bibles, you're going to find our text beginning today on page 222. And I'm going to be actually working us kind of all the way through the book. But here, let me share with you my premise this morning about what we want to learn from Ruth about how to be faithful in our journey with God. And, you know, there were two guys in the 1980s who were Major League Baseball pitchers. These are the guys who had become literally the pinnacle of their sport. One of the guys was a reliever. He was pitching for a team, and they were in the playoffs. They were deep into the playoffs. And he had his dream moment arise for him. He was pitching out of the bullpen. The game was on the line. Great hitter was at the plate. He was called in from the bullpen to get this one guy out. Instead, the guy hit a home run off of him. They lost the game. They were knocked out of the playoffs. He never made it back to the playoffs again. He was absolutely devastated. In that circumstance, I mean, for anybody, that's not an unpleasant circumstance. Most of you would say it's just a game, what's the big deal, whatever. This is this guy's life mission. He comes in, he fails. The circumstance is overwhelming. His response was he continued just the anger and the depression just continued to grow. Within 3 years, he had a moment in his life where he was in his home. He injured his wife, and then he took his own life by suicide. This circumstance overwhelmed him, and he couldn't cope with it. There's another pitcher in the 1980s. His name was Dave Dravecki. Some of you know his story. Another major league pitcher, a left-hander. They always make more money, the left-handers, you know. Very successful starter, prominent, part of centerpiece of a major trade from one team to the other on the West Coast. In the middle of his career, they discovered he had cancer in his shoulder. They had to do surgery. He was out of the league for a year or more in rehabilitation, managed to make it back to the big leagues again, pitched, the cancer returned. The end result was that they had to remove his left arm and his left shoulder, just totally amputate and take it away. His reaction was to turn that around because of his Christian faith and turn it into a ministry. Started to write books, started to teach, started to encourage people in difficult moments, and etc. So here's my premise to us today as we begin to look at the story of Ruth and what it can teach us, is that we will have circumstances that are going to arise in our lives that are going to be damaging and destructive, painful. It's going to happen. What I want to suggest to you is how we respond to those circumstances, unfortunately, can be equally as destructive if we don't process them the right way. And I believe that the Scripture teaches us, based upon what God says, when all things work for the good of those who love the Lord, there is a way for us as the children of God to process experiences so we can take harmful circumstances and we can process those in a healthy way. We can take hurtful moments and we can process those in a healing way. We can take destructive experiences and by God's grace, they can be constructive and edifying, have constructive and edifying results in our lives. It's not easy to do that. The book of Ruth gives us some great pictures to that. Let me tell you the story real quick, and then we'll jump around the text. There's a family that's living in Bethlehem in the days of the judges. As often, the people were rebellious against the Lord. They weren't really doing what they were supposed to do, that kind of stuff. They had been brought into the land by the God who was the only God, the sovereign God, but again, to be worship other gods and starting to live like everybody else around them who didn't believe in God, didn't believe in their God. So God was bringing judgment upon them, discipline, trying to draw them back like a father trains his child so that they do what's right. Result of that, there was famine in the land. This particular family decided to move. So they picked up and the mother's name was Naomi. There were two boys, Mahlon and Chilion, and the father's name was Elimelech. And they moved to the land of Moab, a land outside of the promised land, southeast corner of of the, if you're looking at the Dead Sea in Palestine today, Moab would have been down in the southeast corner. So it's on the east side, the southern section of the Dead Sea. They go there. Both of the sons get married. There's more harvest in the land. There's more food to be had, that kind of stuff. While they're there for a decade, the father and both sons die. So Naomi is left with her two foreign daughter-in-laws. She decides that she's going to return to Bethlehem because she heard that God has restored his favor to the people and there's food in the land. While she's going, she realizes there's no future for her daughter-in-laws with her in Israel, back in Bethlehem. So she urges them to go home, go back to their father's households, find new husbands, live new lives, have a future. One leaves. Her name is Orpha. The other one refuses. Her name is Ruth. She, you know, and we'll talk about that in a minute. They get back to Bethlehem. She comes into the city, into the village. It creates a big stir. They didn't know what had happened to them. Haven't heard from them in 10 years. All that kind of stuff. And she says, you know what? Don't call me Naomi anymore, because Naomi means pleasant. She said, my life's not pleasant. Call me Mara, because that means bitter, because my life is bitter. When they're back there, the ancient world was not an easy place for women without a husband. Dangerous place. And so they're in a position where they're back. They have land. It's not been harvested. It's not been planted. It's not been cultivated. And so Ruth gets up and just goes and begins to glean food from whatever field she can find. By God's providence, she finds herself in the field of a man of character who also happens to stand in the line of the one who can be her redeemer. Now, this is a foreign concept to us, right? But lineage, family lineage, was extremely important in the ancient world. And so often what would happen is if a son died without any children, his widow would marry a brother and would raise a family up in his late brother's name. When there was no other siblings to marry, no other brothers to marry, what would happen was that somebody else who was in the clan would have the right or with a responsibility to marry this widow and raise a family up in the name of the deceased. And so they wouldn't be his descendants, and none of the estate would go to his side of the family. It would all go to the wife's side of the family. And Boaz was one of those guys. And as the story unfolds, Ruth lands up being redeemed by Boaz, and we'll look at that in a few minutes. The result of it is that they have a child. His name is Obed. Obed gets married. His wife gives birth to a guy by the name of Jesse. And Jesse's son, his youngest son, was David, who became King David. And so this Moabite woman, left destitute without a husband, living in a land that was foreign from her, God raises her up, and she literally becomes one of the grandparents of the Messiah. It's a tremendous story of redemption. And it's a tremendous story of how God works and how we can navigate the difficult moments in our lives in a way where they add to who we are, not tear apart who we are. And so I want to look at some pieces. Now, I always want to be faithful to the text. The purpose of the book of Ruth is to show us a little bit, a deeper dive into the genealogy of Jesus. And the reason that we are told about Ruth is because it begins to show that what God is going to do in Jesus is universal. It's not just for the Jews, it's for all peoples. And so here you have generations before Jesus would be born, you know, almost 1,000 years or more before Jesus would be born, you see a Moabite woman being woven into how God is working in history to redeem it. It's an incredible message. But there's some great points, I think, that you and I can see from this journey. Now, you know, and I don't think I'm going to say anything that the Scripture doesn't support overall. Occasionally, I'll make a few points from other passages to kind of support what I'm saying. But hopefully you've turned in the book of Ruth to chapter 1, and we're on page 222 in your pew Bible. And let me just read the first three verses for us. During the time of the judges, again, the people are in the promised land. There's no king. God's supposed to be their king, right? They do what God says. Everything works great. Often they weren't doing that, right? And it led to discipline. So during the time of the judgments, during the time, I think, of one of their times of rebellion against God, they're just living like everybody else and not really being the people of God, he says there was a famine in the land. And a man left Bethlehem in Judah with his wife and two sons to live in the land of Moab for a while. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi. The sons' names were Mahlon and Chilion, and they were Ephraimites from Bethlehem in Judah. And they entered the land of Moab and settled there. Now Naomi's husband, Elimelech, died, and she was left with her two sons. Then her two sons married. They married Moabite women. One of the daughter-in-law's names was Orpah, and the second was Ruth. And they lived in Moab for 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion. After they had lived in Moab after 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left with her, without her husband and without her two children. Now, one of the things, though, I think that's important for us as we start this journey is that I really think that one of the things that we need to do in order to be able to navigate troublesome times well is that we really need to be alert. We need to be discerning. I think there are many moments in our journey where we let the circumstances get worse than they have to be just because we don't pay attention, we don't respond, or we actually throw gasoline on the fire and we turn it into a huge blaze, right? I mean, we make things work. We need to be alert and discerning in what's happening around us. Now, I realize that there are some things that just happen suddenly, you know, and families, you know, where we had a woman who worshiped with us for a short season a number of years ago, you know, gets up in the morning, her son goes off to work, he's killed in a car accident. It's over. It's immediate experience. Other times, it's stuff that's coming in a journey, right? The marriage just doesn't seem like it used to be. But you know what? We're busy and this and that. And, you know, we'll get around to working on it later, you know? And or spiritually, you know, I don't know. I just don't feel like I'm in the same place with God that I used to be. But right now, there's a lot of stuff, you know, and we just let stuff start to slide. Here are the people of Israel. They got famine in the land. The reason they have famine in the land is because they're not paying attention to God. And this guy's reaction, instead of being discerning, to say, I need to repent, I need to leave my people to repent, says, let's go someplace else where there's food. No, that's not necessarily a bad strategy, if you would say, but sometimes we don't see what's really going on, and there's a need for us to be discerning, to stay alert, to not just be reacting to our circumstances, but actually seeing how God's working in the midst of our experiences and circumstances so we can respond in a way of faithfulness. The second truth I want to show it out to you. So there's this idea of be discerning. You know, what is God doing here? What do I need? Why is this happening? And is there a way in which I'm not who I'm supposed to be? And to be discerning, to stay alert to our circumstances. Pay attention to what's going on physically, emotionally, relationally, spiritually. Just staying on top of the circumstance. The next is in the terminology I'm going to use here, is we need to learn how to hug the divine coastline. And you know, this may not be, you know, I'm not much of a sailor, right? You know, I have a boat, but I'm not much of a sailor. You know, Christina and I were blessed. We inherited a lake house from my parents and up in New Hampshire when they passed away. And so we've been able to enjoy it. And you know, Wanapisaki actually, you know, it's not the ocean, but there are times depending upon what boat you're in, it can seem a little bigger, you know. And you can get out there and there's time where the wind can generate 3 to 4 foot waves. Now, when you find yourself on the other side of the lake, and it's a 30 to 40-minute ride home through 3 to 4 foot waves, I mean, that's a rough ride, and you're going slower and all those kinds of things. One of the tricks that you can do is if you find the shortest paths through the wind, and you can get over on the coastline that the wind is coming over, when you get along the coast, the waves are much smaller. I think they refer to that as the leeward side, right? That's the side where the wind's coming from. There's more protection from the land. There's smaller waves. It allows you to travel less. Boom, 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 boom. I call it the Wanapisaki massage. You know, you're just getting bounced around in your boat a lot. You know, kind of idea. You know, and there's ways in which you and I need to learn. Look what happens here, right? Let's pick up the story in verse 6. So she and her daughter-in-law is prepared to leave the land of Moab. Why? Because she had heard in Moab that the Lord had paid attention to his people by providing them food. Naomi instinctively knows it's better to be back in the place where the protection of God with God's people is there. And so she's looking and seeking to go back. And one of the most positive things that you and I can do when we get into moments where life is not being kind to us is to make sure that we are doubling our efforts to seek refuge in God, in the shelter of God, in the presence of God, in the promises of God, in the teachings of God. You know, there's a tremendous psalm, Psalm chapter 1. I don't know how often you get into the Psalms. I'm not much of a poet, and I often struggle with them, but Psalm 1 is a great psalm. It's interesting. The other day I was playing golf by myself, and there were a couple guys, I think they wanted to warm up with their league, and I was coming along to the last two holes, and so they said, hey, can we jump on with you and play 17 and 18 so we can kind of warm up? And I said, sure. So they teed off with me. We're walking down the fairway. These two guys are swearing like sailors, right? You know, just back and forth and this and that. We get to the 18th tee, and the guy said, well, you know, what do you do for a living? I said, well, I pastor a church in Sterling. And we start walking down the hill, and the next thing you know, he's talking to me about Psalm 1, you know, And the only difficulty was that you could tell he was trying to repeat memory banks from 30 years ago, right? You know, he said, there's something in there about, you know, being nice by the river kind of, you know. But just listen to these words from Psalm 1, 1 through 3. This is the promise God makes to us if you and I will live in the shelter of God when we hit in the moments of stuff. He says, happy is the man who does not follow the advice of the wicked or take the paths of sinners or join a group of mockers. Instead, his delight is in the Lord's instruction, and he meditates on day and night. This is the guy who doesn't go to the other side where he's going to find the biggest waves as far away from God as he can get, but he gets over close, and he's hugging the coastline of God, if you will, underneath the protection of God as he meditates and delights in God. And he said he's going to be like a tree planted beside streams of water that bears its fruit in season and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does is going to prosper. The imagery there is whether it rains or not, because he's planted by the stream, the tree is going to produce its fruit. It's going to be healthy. Some of you have grass that's in the shade. It's still green. Others of you have grass, like most of my yard, out in the sun. It's a wonderful brown color right now, right? You know, it's the same kind of imagery if we will live in the shade of God, close to the streams of God, we're going to flourish. And there's a need for us to hug the divine coastline, seek God, stay close to God, and be with God. Not run from God, not blame God, but stay in the presence of God. Here's the third truth that I want you to see. Going back over to the book of Ruth. I want to pick up with verse 7, and I want to read down through verse 17, actually through verse 18. So now, Naomi and her two daughter-in-laws, it says, they left the place where they had been living, and then accompanied by her two daughter-in-laws, traveled along the road leading back to the land of Judah. So they're traveling along the east side of the Dead Sea, making their way up where they can cross and go on up into Israel and into the village of Bethlehem. And while they're traveling, Naomi says, each of you go back to your mother's home. May the Lord show faithful love to you as you have shown to the dead and to me. May the Lord enable each of you to find security in the house of your new husband. And so she kissed them, and they wept loudly. And no, they kept saying to her, we will go with you to your people. But Naomi replied, return home, my daughters. Why do you want to go with me? Am I able to have more sons who could become your husbands? Return home. So I'm too old to have any more kids. You're not going to find a husband in my family, you know. Return home, my daughters. Go on, for I'm too old to have another husband. And even if I were to still have hope for me to have a husband tonight and to bear sons, would you be willing to wait for them to grow up? In other words, you're going to be old ladies by the time my new kids would get marrying age. Would you restrain yourself from remarrying? No. So she's saying, you know, they're on the way back, and she's saying, there's no future for you with me. There's no future for you with me. Go back. Just go back to your own household. And I'll pray that God will send another man to be your husband so that you can have a life with him. And again, it was a tough world in those days for a single woman, almost impossible. And one of the daughter-in-laws, Orpha, she sees the wisdom in it. She kisses her mother-in-law goodbye, and she leaves. But Ruth refuses. And we pick up in verse 15. Naomi says, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her God. Follow your sister-in-law. Go, go, go. There's no... And this is what Ruth says. Many of you probably had this read at your wedding. I know it was read at my wedding. Do not persuade me to leave you or to go back and not follow you. For where you're going to go, I will go. And where you live, I'm going to live. And your people will be my people. And your God will be my God. Where you die, that's where I'm going to die. And there I'll be buried. May the Lord do this to me and even more if anything but death separates you and me. When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped trying to persuade her. So here's my point to you. It's really simple. When you get into difficult moments, you see it coming and you're seeking God, just maintain an unswerving commitment to do what's right. Ruth is on the road with Naomi. Naomi is an older woman. She got a long way to travel. If she is a woman traveling by herself the roads, her prayer of getting home by herself are zip. When she gets back to her city, village, if she's there by herself, she has no hope of survival. And Ruth says, I don't care. It would be wrong in the eyes of God for me to abandon you, and I'm not going to. And she is absolutely committed to doing what is right. And I got to tell you, that is a foundation that every single one of us needs to grab onto. We sometimes get into these difficult moments and we think we've got to create the solutions or God's abandoned us or God's ways don't really work or whatever. And we just stop doing what's right. We think we can figure this out and some come up with better ways. And sometimes we just need to be fundamentally committed to what is right. You know, when you get into a marriage, it's starting to struggle a little, but just being committed to the vow that you made to your spouse is powerful stuff. When you get into struggles as a parent and your children aren't responding, or you know, that you understand the responsibility you have before God and you just stick to it, and the list just goes on and on. It's true. It's powerful just to do what is right. And this is not limited to Ruth in this book. You get over into chapter 3. At the beginning of the chapter, Naomi says, you know what? I have a responsibility to you. You've stuck with me. We're living here in Bethlehem. It's my job to help you build a future. She said, this is what I want you to do. And she does what's right in her responsibility to her daughter-in-law when they're back in Bethlehem. As the story unfolds, we'll see a little bit more of it as we go through. But she gets to a place where she's actually kind of come into the underneath the orbit of her redeemer Boaz. So Boaz was a kinsman of Ruth's husband, and obviously of her father-in-law as well. And he stood in a position where he could redeem her in the land. That means he could buy the land from Naomi, the widow, and he could marry Ruth. He could raise up a family, but all of those children would be considered to be the children of Ruth's late husband. So he wouldn't really have any family of his own through Ruth. It would all belong to Ruth. And he's making this commitment to do this. But there's another guy who should have first dibs on that privilege, if you will. And so as the story unfolds in chapter 4, Boaz agrees that he's going to try to be her redeemer. He goes to the city gates. All business was conducted in the city gates. And you actually go there and they actually have excavated, you know, some cities, and you can see that they actually had stone benches at the city gates where people sat. Boaz goes there. This other guy comes by, one of his kinsmen as well, obviously. He says, hey, stop for a minute. I need to talk to you about something. He says, Naomi's selling her land, and you have first right because you're the first redeemer. Do you want the land? The guy says, yeah, I want the land. That's good. I'll buy it. And he said, well, okay, good. That means you also get Ruth as your wife, and you'll be raising up a family in her late husband's name. And he's like, I can't afford to take my money and invest it in somebody else's estate. So I pass. You can do it. And they have 10 witnesses around, right? And he says, so I'm passing and you have the right. And Boaz says, I will take the right. I will raise up, right? And the way they sealed the transaction back then was they exchanged a shoe, right? Imagine if we did this today in legal work. You know, you're going to sell a piece of property and say, okay, here's my shoe. This is my promise, you know. And that's what they did. They literally took off a shoe and gave him a sandal, you know. And the sandal became, I guess it was your deed, you know. It was like your deed. You know, they gave up the right, signed the contract, you were done. If you exchanged shoes, it was like shaking hands, I guess, you know. And maybe things would be simpler today if we did that. You know, when you go to you take out your mortgage and you sign a document that says, I'm Neil Davidson, and the next document says I didn't lie on the previous document, and then the next document says I didn't lie on the previous two documents, and it's amazing how much legal work we go through, right? That's all a distraction. Boaz, he could have just grabbed Ruth, grabbed the land, gone, whatever, but he did what was right, and he did it the right way. There is power in the midst of our difficulties of just sticking and doing what is right. Not falling to our circumstances, but being victorious in our circumstances. A couple of other truths I want to point out to you. And we're going to move really quickly here. The fourth thing is you've got to stay teachable. You've got to stay growing. One of the questions you have to ask yourself when you're in the midst of these difficult experiences is, what is God trying to teach me? What can I learn? How can I grow? How can I mature? This story of Ruth might be the only time in history when a daughter-in-law did exactly what his mother-in-law told her to do. You know, I mean, you know, so if you read through chapter 3, you know, Naomi says, you know what, Boaz is a great option for you, so this is what I want to tell you to do. First of all, go take a bath. You don't smell good. Go take a bath. Then put on your good clothes, put on some perfume, make yourself look and smell presentable, right? Then I want you to go down to the threshing room floor. So they would have harvested all day long, and then they would have come back and then at night, when you couldn't harvest out of the fields, they would thresh everything, trying to get the grain out from the chaff and all that kind of stuff. And then when they got done doing all of that, and the day was finally over, then they would eat a big meal, have a lot to drink, and then they would fall asleep and start over the next day, and they would do so at the threshing room. So Naomi tells her to go on down there, and she lays down at her feet. And she said, you know, what I want you to do is once you've seen him fall asleep, you sneak up, raise up the blanket off of his feet, lay down at his feet. And that's basically a petition. It's a request that you're making of him to extend his blanket out over you, to take you, if you will, into his bed and become his wife. And so a very bold thing. And Ruth does exactly what Naomi tells her to do. Because Naomi knows how to play the Hebrew customs to make them work. And so Ruth stays completely teachable. Like I said, it may be the only time in history when a daughter-in-law has done exactly what her mother-in-law told her to do. But she stays teachable. And there's a need for us to stay teachable, to stay alert, and to see, what do I need to learn? How do I need to grow? How do I need to change? What can I gather from all of this? And often we get into, it's like, why is this happening to me? And et cetera. And we get into that mode instead of letting God use it to grow us and to change us. There's also a point where I think in the midst of all of this is there's a need for us just to stay active. To stay active. You know, kind of backing up in the story a little bit, I think sometimes when you and I face difficulties and we feel overwhelmed, we have a tendency to withdraw and to sit, right? You know, life gets hard, you know, so we start dropping out of our life group because I don't really feel like going, and we don't make it to worship very often, and you know, I'm not praying the way that I used to, and you know, I'm not really connecting with my friends, or you know, something gets hard and all that stuff you were doing to work, get healthy and lose weight, you just start pumping the comfort food, and et cetera. You know, we just get into a place where we go from being active to being passive. We let our circumstances overwhelm us instead of taking the initiative in the midst of it. Not trying to usurp the providence or the sovereignty of God, but inside of what God's already revealed to do is doing everything that we can to grow and to mature and to provide and to be victorious in the midst of our circumstances. Ruth and Naomi, they get back to Bethlehem. You look at the beginning of chapter 2. You know, they get back there. Ruth is now a foreigner living in this village. Her mom has, her mother-in-law has come back to the village in disgrace. So they got no social pedigree at all, right? She may speak Hebrew, right? But she's certainly speaking it with an accent. And she, one of the most dangerous things a woman could do in those days was something that was actually provided for in the Jewish law, which was to go out to a field by herself and glean after the harvesters to get the food. That was kind of like their welfare program, right? The harvesters would go through. The men would go through and cut all the sheaves. There would be servant girls who would come along before and pick up the pieces that kind of got lost, the pieces that kind of broke off. And then usually, and the owners of the field and everybody wanted this to be hours, if not days later, people could come through, and if there was anything still left in the ground, they could pick it up, and if they could get some wheat off of it, it was theirs. And the law forbid them to actually go back and try to redo their fields before the poor people could come in. But here Ruth goes out. She's a woman traveling by herself, very vulnerable to attack, like certain parts of our world today, right? You know, and she goes out on her own. She says, listen, I'm not going to sit here and do nothing. I'm going to go get some food. So she goes out and she starts gleaning. And she's in the field behind the servant girls while they're still gleaning, which is very dangerous. Most times they would have sent some men over there to run her off or attack her or whatever, saying, get out of our field until we're done with our field, right? And she stays active. I'm not going to just sit here and starve to death. I'm going to go out and start looking for food. And by God's providence, he leads her into the field of Boaz. And he shows her great favor. But that idea of staying active, staying alert, just don't, you know, sometimes when we get into difficult moments, whether it's related to our vocations and our career or our finances or our health or relationships or emotionally, whatever, we get into difficult places, we stop doing the stuff we know we should be doing. We just stop. And part of what you need to learn is don't do that. Stay active. Keep doing the stuff that you need to do because they are the rudder that God uses to navigate through the whole thing with us. I've got one last point. You really have to trust in the redeeming power of God. Here is a woman who is a Moabite, outside the promises of God. Her husband dies. She's childless. She's landless. You couldn't get into a worse position than she was in the ancient world for a woman. Yet God brings her into the covenant people, the people of promise, and she makes your God my God, as we read. She gets redeemed by a man of great substance and wealth in his village, and she gets to become one of the grandparents of the Messiah. What a story of redemption. And part of the thing that you and I need to believe is that when God says all things work for the good of those who love the Lord, it's not just words on a page. It's true. When you're in the midst of difficulty, one of the things that we need to be asking ourselves is, how in the world can God use this? How does God desire to use this? God seeks to redeem it. He seeks for it to have a value, to extend his kingdom and have an impact. And we could all tell tons of stories of guys who, of individuals who have struggled with, whether it's health issues like a Dave Drabecki or somebody who struggled with alcoholism and now has found victory in it and has become an aid and a support to others who are struggling with it, or people who have been through a marriage that experienced adultery and they've recovered from it and now they can be encouragers and teachers to others, and the list can just go on and on. You know, for unemployment, you know, one of the best people to support and encourage others who are going through unemployment, or those who have been there and done that before. List just goes on and on. But God uses our experiences to equip us to minister to others. He seeks to redeem them. And those words are not just words on the page, but they are the reality of how God is working in our lives, that all things work for the good if we will just love the Lord. God can actually use it in a redemptive way. So part of the question I have for all of us this morning is, what does God need to redeem in your life today? What does God need to redeem in your life today? What hurt, what harm, what difficulty, what failure, what loss, whatever, what does God need to redeem in your life today? How can you navigate through these difficult times in a way that brings glory and honor to the Lord. It's what God seeks to do all the time. It's why he sent his son, so that when you and I turn back from a life of sin and choose to become followers of Christ, God can take that which was broken and alienated and separated from him, just really had no hope at all of eternity, and can turn it into something that he can use as a lighthouse for the world. What is God trying to redeem in your life today?